It's Friday, March 30th. Did you see the news? A forthcoming paper in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, as reported by the BBC, suggests that there may be tens of billions of habitable planets in this galaxy alone. Perhaps even as many as 100 within 30 light-years of Earth. Wow! I hope we live in a respectable neighborhood, but I keep thinking that, whatever the case, we're going to need an interstellar diplomatic corps. Sign me up! Welcome to Electric Politics. I'm George Kinney. Sometimes it's good to just reflect on things. Ed and I talk for 30 minutes. Let's listen. Today, I'm extremely honored and absolutely delighted to have as my guest Ed Asner, who needs no further introduction. Welcome, Ed.
Well, welcome to you, George.
Well, thanks very much for talking with me. And I guess to start, I should also thank David Crow in Canada of Rethinking AIDS, who put us together. And you're associated with David's group. And I was just curious how you became aware of this issue.
What, of AIDS?
Yeah.
Well, I was approached, was approached very early on in the AIDS epidemic by two gentlemen who were making a documentary on the subject. And I contributed my voice as narrator to the project, and they came quite aware of the epidemic and the fact I was an early voice on it. So I guess I've been a in the army of attackers ever since.
In terms being skeptical about the AIDS virus itself, though, wasn't there another film student who had you narrate her film project about the sort of an alternative view of AIDS?
Yes, yes. I'm glad to see that you're aware of that. I'm not equipped to distinguish, but it seemed like a worthy subject to put forward with the scientists that are involved. So I was happy to contribute my voice to her project.
Well, it's interesting, and that's quite courageous, because a lot of these people, for example, there's a professor, Peter Duisberg at Berkeley, who's gotten a lot of flack over the years and who's been accused of having contributed to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, because he's saying, well, there are other ways of treating this disease, and the virus itself may not be the actual culprit. So to take on something like that, even to say, well, this is something worth looking at, is pretty remarkable.
Well, I think she's a wonderful, talented girl who certainly took a big chunk of the apple.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that it resonates and draws attention and investigation. And prophets have been stoned to death before, so I hope that there's validity in what she has to say.
Ed, before turning to what I'm really most interested in talking about, which is American politics, let me just raise one other sort of controversial subject that you're known to be associated with, and that's the 9/11 skeptic movement. I noticed in today's Asia Times Online, which is a fairly reputable electronic paper coming out of Asia, there's a big story on the financial options that were exercised after 9/11, and a very long story, and describes some very suspect connections between former senior CIA types and various traders. So obviously there's continued interest in the part of skeptics to explain what was going on in 9/11, and I'm curious also how you first got involved in that.
Well, I smelled a rat from the moment it was occurring. Just looking at those buildings, I could not accept the fact that planes brought them down. I don't care what kind of engineering response occurs. I prefer to identify with the 1,000 architects and engineers who believe that demolition was involved in bringing the buildings down. Plus the fact that I've made a 10-minute film with Mark Rydell. Brian Connors wrote and directed it, which has been shown at a number of festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And the key point that we discuss in there is nobody seems to ever reflect or talk about Building Number 7, which was brought down at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quote from the owner of the building who collected maybe billions from the insurance saying that we have to pull it, which means demolish it. Well, the point is, to demolish a building, you have to do an enormous amount of preparation. It was brought down that day. Where and when did the explosives be brought in to demolish that 47-story building, which was damaged by falling debris from the other buildings, but certainly and also housed all of the records of all the intelligence agencies that were located at that spot.
And a lot of government bond traders and that kind of thing, too.
Yeah.
And recently, I guess you're probably aware of this, Niels Herit, a professor in Denmark, has shown that there's a curious profusion of nanothermite particles in the dust from the debris that couldn't really be explained other than somehow this very high exotic explosive was used in the demolition.
That's right. It would take that to melt steel.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, steel melted all over the place there.
When I talk about 9/11 from time to time, I don't make a big deal out of it. And I don't want to offend too many people, and I still want to have what limited entree.
Oh, come on, offend them.
How do you draw the line between offending people and being diplomatically silent, as it were, in public over this issue?
Well, that's the problem with our country, with the world in general.
Mm.
People don't want to offend. People don't want to provoke. And so they keep their mouths shut, and by keeping their mouths shut, truth never gets to surface.
Well, this is interesting, and it's a perfect seg into politics, because there's another aspect of not offending, actually several, to put it mildly. But the other day in the New York Times, there was some op-ed by a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia who purports to explain the differences between the right and the left in America, and he's saying, well, we have different narratives. And so these narratives are in conflict, but it's basically a kind of a moral equivalence. And so he gets past this whole question of anybody being right. And yet, in reality, there is one side that is correct and thinking logically, and the other side that is not and is dangerous. And you've pointed this out with reference to FDR, that he was a scrappy guy.
Yeah.
But why is it that we always want to take the easy way and not think about hard problems and think about conflicts?
Well, my simplified answer is this. In America, people don't want to hear stories that would indict this country that they believe so fervently in and its way of government. They don't want to call it the myth of America. They don't want to think that in high places of our country, the people who govern us, that there would be scoundrels.
Mm-hmm.
Scoundrels who would kill 3,000 people to achieve their ends. I believe such people exist. Then there are those other people who realize that even though you may have something that's hot and troublesome, they don't want to hear it, because if they hear it and become involved, they might become suspect by the bad guys.
That's all true. Yeah, but you're talking about scoundrels on the level of personality, and I have an even more difficult question. And you were talking about this with Tom Hartman in a way, when you were talking about how you're waiting for lightning to strike, in a sense, and people to get excited and want change. But the change that I look for really is more structural, and it seems to me that we're kind of locked into almost a 16th century way of doing things, and that our political system isn't designed, was never designed, and can't cope with the 21st century, and that we really have to rethink the basic constitution of the United States and maybe have a new one. But that kind of question, the what are the incentives operating on people, and is it normal, in a sense, for people to act in these terrible ways? That question is difficult. How would you respond to that?
I don't know how to respond to it. All I know is that if we have to rethink the Constitution, that's fine, as long as Justice Scalia isn't part of the prow of that discovery.
Yeah, and that's the nub of the problem, in a way. If you redo it, who are all the people who will be the redoing?
Exactly.
Do you think it might be a worthy thing to pursue? I mean, other than changing the system, what if we have to change the people, I suppose.
Well, I haven't made a study of it, but perhaps the fact that we are locked into a two-party system, and that other countries seem to thrive and change momentarily by form of the parliamentary system, I wonder if we could ever see our way clear to thinking in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
To provide relief to this stifling, suffocating process of the two-party system, which I'm often reminded of the governments in Latin America during their most, they're always troubled. But it used to be that the liberals would take over, and they would perform perfidy, and then the conservatives would take over, and they'd perform perfidy.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that we're almost emulating a South American government these days.
Yeah, it's almost a cliche, but it's we've got a tyranny of the minority, whichever way we go.
Exactly.
When you talk about something that's going to really galvanize people, we've seen the Occupy movement sort of rise up, and then it doesn't, at least to me, doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It kind of hasn't found a way for itself.
They let things fizzle on the street.
Yeah.
Over a million people marched in the streets against the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
Didn't mean a thing.
What kinds of things do you look for to get large numbers of people engaged?
I guess I don't look for anything. I tend to think that unless things get really terrible, if they keep scraping the scum off the top of the cake, we'll continue to eat the cake. And only when things become desperate do people finally decide to take to the streets and force a change a la Egypt. And there, God knows how much outside help they had there from the Western powers in overthrowing Mubarak.
Probably a lot.
Yeah.
Certainly there were a lot of activists who would earn their spurs in places like Yugoslavia and who had been in Egypt for at least a year or probably much more, training in civil disobedience and things like that.
Yeah.
Not to mention what's going on in Syria, where you've not only got Western activists like that, but you've got these scattered, unconfirmed reports of Western military officers helping the...
Sure.
So...
We're dismembering Iran when we do it.
Yeah, exactly. But when you talk about U.S. politics in such apocalyptic terms, though, I have to look at Europe, and for all its troubles, the Europeans managed to accept some variations on socialism that actually provide a pretty good life, at least in Northern Europe, with health care and education and retirement and wage protection, all under attack. But still, they've got a lot more than we've got, and they've managed to do that in a way that didn't in recent history involve of major upheavals and revolutions. I often look to Europe as an example, but I noticed that in the mainstream, not so many do. And why is it, do you think, that not so many Americans look abroad and try to compare the U.S. to what others are doing?
Well, it's that independent streak of America, which does not which forbears involvement in across the water. It's the enormous fundamental streak that runs through this country, backed by religion. It's the stubborn, maverick American way, so that you raise the cry of socialism,
mm-hmm.
and people start to run and hide under cover. It's the bugaboo, and yet it is socialism that has brought relief to the individual citizen in most of those European countries.
I would guess, and I haven't really seen numbers on this, but I would guess that on the coasts and in the more highly educated parts of the country, socialism is not such a scare word. But when you talk about fundamentalists and religion, in a lot of ways we're talking about the Deep South, and I really wonder how the rest of the country is supposed to deal with that section of people. You had Nancy Pelosi's daughter the other day doing a film about Mississippi for the Bill Maher show, and it was pretty devastating and funny maybe to us, but not to them. But people in the poorest state, the least educated state, are the most conservative, and if they're left to their own devices, they're going to take away women's rights, and they're going to insist on teaching evolution in schools and so forth. And since the majority of the country doesn't believe in those things, I have to wonder, is it right for us to let them do that in Mississippi?
You say the majority of the country. Well, it's barely a majority if it is a majority. Secondly, I read someplace where something like 80-some percent in Mississippi believe still that Obama is a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So with that type of education, with the descent of education in this country getting worse, what hope do we have until we start educating our people in terms of a national viewpoint rather than the isolated fundamentalist education that they're being steeped in their individual states?
Do you suspect, Ed, that the ruling class, the super rich, kind of have an interest in keeping most people pretty dumb?
Well, I go back to the principle that in the Deep South it was a criminal to teach a slave to read.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we are seeing a modern form of that process going on now, I think. Along with the circuses that we are constantly provided for, and in this particular case, I would think electronically, we're given those circuses with every new invention.
So people are distracted all the time.
Yeah.
And how can people get undistracted?
I guess we have to go broke.
Well, it would help the obesity rate in the U.S., I suppose.
And being a fat person, I certainly agree with
well,
that.
Well, I share your misery.
Au revoir.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on specifics, what do you make of Barack Obama's presidency? Do you have anything good to say about
well,
it?
Well, I haven't been applauding for these first 3 years, and I'm certainly well aware of the enemy, who has certainly done their best to capitalize on a black man in the White House,
mm-hmm.
and played on those fears all the way along.
Mm-hmm.
I realize all that, and yet I don't applaud him because with the attempts and the success he's made, I feel he could have made them just as well if he had gone whole hog. Gone mm-hmm. for a bigger health plan, gone for a bigger stimulus plan. I tend to digest Paul Krugman rather religiously.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he called for those things from the very get-go.
Mm-hmm, he did. Paul Krugman's been excellent on a lot of issues.
And then to betray us in terms of Guantanamo, in terms of waterboarding, in terms of rendition, in many ways... half steps when full strides would not have made things worse.
He could have had
possibly better.
Yeah. the whole debt thing, he let the Republicans dictate the agenda when he could have just had a confrontation, said, well, if you don't pass this debt ceiling, I'm going to print money anyway and just try and stop me.
And he could have, instead of his pussyfooting compromise efforts, could have emulated Roosevelt, who ended up saying, I love my enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a person is defined by their enemies in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any possibility of somebody like Roosevelt reappearing absent a total meltdown of American society?
Have you not witnessed the hegira from Congress of late? Any potential Roosevelt that was there seems to be departing.
Congress and at the state level, too. Well, there's got to be a positive way out of this. I'm sure that this, despite what you've just said, that you must remain an optimist, Ed.
I wish I could.
Well, when you think optimistic thoughts, what gives you cause to be optimistic?
Only witnessing the success of local groups.
Uh-huh.
People uniting, combining, and fighting to a purpose, to a simple purpose, and succeeding in it. Though all around them may be a rabid right-wing milieu, they thrive and achieve success with the small projects that they have set out to do and serve as an example to the nation as a whole.
How about in terms of ideas? I'm struck, for example, again to take an international case of what happened in Greece, where the international community said to Greece, "Well, you have to pay back these banks, and never mind how you got into debt, and you have to become poor in order to satisfy this very rich group of people." And the Greeks have sort of said, despite a lot of objections on the street, the Greeks have sort of said, yeah, okay, we don't really seem to have a better alternative, so we'll do that, or we'll try, we'll pretend to make the effort, and we'll get more loans. But there hasn't been anybody in Greece to stand up and say, well, wait a minute, in a very popular way, wait a minute, this whole system is wrong. And I wonder whether there's a poverty of ideas among the left in Greece, here, in Britain, in a lot of places, to be able to articulate what it is that people should be for.
Well, once again, I go to Krugman, and you know, and not deeply, but Krugman has always felt that the swearing of allegiance to the euro is what has created much of Greece's problems.
Mm-hmm.
That It is not starvation that is the cure. It is stimulus. And
classic Keynesianism.
The Greeks, a bygone civilization. The Greeks would fare far better if they said, to hell with the euro. We're going back to our own currency. And we're going to try to stimulate our economy to the nth degree. That's about the only thing that's left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which we could do here, obviously, in the U.S. Instead of focusing, as Krugman always says, on the debt, we should be focusing on creating jobs and rebuilding the economy. One area where Krugman, I think, misses the boat is he's still classical old-school economics and thinking that free trade is always advantageous, and yet there's been fairly recent theoretical work, and there's a lot of empirical work that suggests that free trade, freely entered into by all the trading partners, is not necessarily to the advantage of all of them. And it seemed to me for a long time that we ought to be intelligent about not letting our industries be shipped overseas and all of our jobs be shipped overseas, and that some protectionism is probably appropriate.
I certainly agree with that.
You do? Oh, I'm glad to hear that. It's a kind of simple idea. It's actually backed up by a very substantial amount of real technical argument. But somehow the debate has been cast for so long in terms of free trade versus benighted protectionists. Smoot-Hawley-Taos, 1930s.
In an ideal world, yes, free trade would be wonderful. But we have an aberrant situation here in the United States. We've been pampered and coddled and held as an example a high form of living, which was supported for a while by our manufacture. Now that they've shipped the manufacture out, you go to a clothing store, every stitch that you find will be made in Bangladesh, Bombay, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
The same with your electronic equipment somewhere in Asia or the Philippines. So nothing is being made here. And the middle class, who was used to making those things and then buying them when we were buying cheaply from those foreign countries, now they can't afford to, they don't make the money, they can't afford to buy.
Right.
So what else is there to do but to return to one's navel?
And the free traders will say, well, everything will be okay once we all have sort of the income level of somebody in Bangladesh.
But the world ain't equal.
Yeah, it's not. It amazes me. You can go into a kitchen supply store and for $15 or $20 buy something that's made in Italy or in Germany. And if they can make something good and ship it here and sell it, why can't we make something good here ourselves? Our mindset is really misplaced on this.
I think liberals and conservatives have both led us down this thorny path.
Yeah. Do you think, it just occurs to me to ask, and it's sort of an off-the-wall question, do you think that political activism might skip a generation, that things are kind of quiet? You probably remember the 60s better than I do. I was pretty young, but certainly there were a lot of people who realized that there were things wrong, the civil rights, the war in Vietnam, and so forth. And we've gone along for a long time now without that generational awareness. Are you hopeful that a new generation might pick up that torch?
I don't see it. I certainly have blind spots, but I would like to throw up my hands in disgust and walk away, and be amazed and aghast at finding that there are young people who will say, "You don't have the answers, and we are going to get them."
Mm-hmm.
And everyone I see is looking into their fiddle or their Twitter or their this or their that, and the human contact and the human outrage seems to be buried in looking for the next program or the next game.
Yeah, all on their iPads or iPhones.
Yeah.
Or, How much of a part, Ed, does humor play or potentially play in all of this?
Well, humor is the best weapon of all. But unfortunately, we don't have that many comics. Bill Maher certainly succeeds well, as does, names escape me, the Colbert Report,
mm-hmm.
Jon Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Where else do you go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I certainly don't find Rush Limbaugh funny.
not intentionally, anyway.
No.
Elaborate on that, please. How is humor the most powerful weapon?
Well, there's a commercial out showing two guys who make claims about their cars, about their manufacture. And their pants start burning. You know, recalling, liar, liar, pants on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a wonderful way, a shortcut way of making a point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if we could find more pants on fire as we shout the cry, I think we'd be more pleased.
I noticed the other day the founder, and I forget his name, the founder of Firesign Theater passed away.
The founder of who?
Firesign Theater.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Where are you based?
I'm in D.C.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll be there for Defenders of Wildlife board meeting in a month or so.
I'm sure you'll have a great time, and I'd love to offer you a cup of coffee or something when you're here, but I'm sure you'll be pretty busy.
I'll be on the run.
Yeah. Well, listen, Ed, I don't want to keep you too long, but I'm, as I say, very honored to talk with you. You're the sort of the civilian equivalent of a four-star general in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And
whose army?
On the good left side of things, in the socialist, okay. Among the socialists.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with me.
Well, I had a good time, George.
Thanks, Ed. I hope, if I live so long, that I can still be open-minded in my 80s. Okay, on to next week. That's a conversation with Dr. Timothy F. Messer-Cruz about his recent book, The Trial of the Haymarket Anarchists, Terror and Justice in the Gilded Age, Palgrave Macmillan, 2011. An interesting story. The Friday following, April 13th, my guest will be Dr. Barbel Honish of Columbia University, talking about her latest paper in the journal Science. She's the lead author among many, in which the team finds that the world's oceans are acidifying at a faster rate today than they were at any time over the past 300 million years. Yes, that's something to think about. Ocean acidification, sometimes called the evil twin of global warming, is going to be another very big, very long-term problem. After that, we'll see. A number of irons are in the fire. Thanks very much to everybody who wrote in last week and who commented at the site. And thanks to Bill in North Carolina for his very kind and generous donation. Remember, I could not keep this project going without your support. All donations are important, and every donation is most welcome. That's it then for this week. As always, it's a real pleasure and a great privilege for me to be able to bring you these shows. I hope you enjoy them. Thanks very much for listening. And please stay tuned to Electric.